All right, let's get started. Thank you. It's just after four. I was helping my friend who just got in the village find the worship planning meeting, but that made me late. But we'll get started. I'm Chris Sharon. I teach at Luther Seminary. I'm here with my wife Sonia and friends Paul and Susan Rohde helping coordinate the teaching staff this summer. They're finishing their 6 weeks, and Sonia and I are starting ours. And Saturday is a flip day when last week's teaching staff all leave and the new teaching staff have just gotten here and don't know which way is up. Well, they know which way is up because they've just come up from the lake, but they're getting settled. So other people offer some sessions on Saturday. And come on in if this is what you're looking for.
I'm
yeah. And one of the questions that I've been interested in is trying to understand some of the big changes in how people engage religion in Western society, the United States, of course, in particular, because that's where I live and have been raised. But it's really true in many places in Western Europe and places influenced by Western Europe, New Zealand, Australia, Canada. And then I think it's also a global urban phenomenon. So if you go to Cape Town, South Africa, for example, which is where we went on a trip last fall, very similar dynamics, religiously speaking, as here. We had two people on teaching staff from South Africa last week. And Christy Johnson, one of the two, was saying same thing, except she had a much better accent when she said it. So what I'd like to do is not so much talk about the facts of being spiritual but not religious, but the background. How did we get to the place where so many people talk that way? I'm just making an assumption that you've heard people talk that way, or you know that many people talk that way, especially younger people talk that way. And I know along the way you'll have competent questions, and I'm not going to do a session that has a big conversation time at the end. I'm going to just stop along the way and check in. So make sure if you have something to say that you say it. Jump in, I'll make space for that, and that way we'll build a conversation all the way along. What I want to start with is this interesting juxtaposition between more or less 500 years ago, when for most people it wasn't even something they would conceive of to not believe in God. The ordinary, if you're thinking about Western Europe, going back to the time when Martin Luther was born, it was a society of people who were more or less faithful in their daily practice and more or less connected to what they considered a holy life. They had a sort of stratified structure of holiness from priests and monks and nuns to ordinary people living their lives in villages and towns. But this question of not believing in God just wasn't something people considered as a way to live your life. It would have been extremely exceptional, and as I'll talk about a little later, very dangerous. Because when you go back that far, the world was enchanted. It was enchanted and full of magic, and the church was a home of powerful good magic. And outside of church or faith was bad magic, worry. And there were worries about the power of magic and spiritual forces. And so it would have been something that would put you or your community at risk if someone was an actual atheist. Did anyone see the film, is it called Pillar of Giants? I'm trying to think of the name of the book. It's a book about a cathedral being built in about the 12th century.
Pillars of the Earth.
Did anyone see that? It was turned into a mini documentary. But in that story about the building of an English cathedral in the 12th century, there's a woman who features in the film, and she's considered sort of a medicine woman, carrying on what probably were pre-Christian traditions of healing. But she was considered by the Christians as a witch and as a threat. And so you can see in this unfolding of this film the way these worlds collide. There's another wonderful children's book series by Nancy Farmer. The first one is Sea of Trolls, and it's about this young boy named Jake, who's a bard in training in the north of England in the 9th century. And it's and the whole plot of the series of three books is this space between the religions of Europe before Christianity and the introduction of Christianity, and how he grows up in between these two worlds. And those two worlds still persisted all the way up into this time, 500 years ago. So the question wasn't really, do you believe in God or not, or do you go to church or not? But these conflicts between powers, believing in God or believing in the gods. So I just want to put that as a marker, and then try and, as we unpack what's happened since then, make some sense of how it is that we have the kind of society that we do, with the kinds of assumptions that we have, and the kinds of ways people talk about and engage in religious life. Go on in. There's chairs up front if you don't mind, but you can sit on tables in the back too. I think sometimes artists portray in images transitions that are happening in society. And so, in a sense, I want to try and unpack what Van Gogh was channeling when he painted this famous painting. Vincent van Gogh's father was a very strict reformed minister. And Van Gogh very early on wanted to be a missionary, but then reacted against it, and in his painting began to sort of tell his dad off. And this painting, in a way, is his depiction of what he felt the effect was. Do you want to flip the light, the front light? It's right behind you, James. Will you turn the light switch? Yeah, that one. Thank you. You can see when you look at this painting that it's an old church tower, but all that's left of the church is the tower. And it's crumbly. It's not in very good repair. And there's black birds flying around the top. You don't know quite what they are, but black birds flying around the top. And then here on the side is a not very well-tended graveyard. And this whole painting, he intended to say, is an icon of what I think of my father's strict Calvinist faith and what will happen to it as people live their lives. And he rejected it, and he, in a sense, found the religious or the spiritual in light. And you can see that in his paintings, trying to portray the holy coming through light. And so in this painting, he really portrayed that not happening. And now, 2009, in our time, is this down? Is that better?
Thank you.
Many people don't believe in God. Paul, will you flip the light back on for James? Thank you. Some of the slides are harder to see with the lights on, so we can adjust if we need to. So I just wanted to see, for example, as a test survey with this mixed group of people who've made it all the way up to Holden Village, how common this really is now that we live knowing people who, let's just start with the easy one, knowing people who never go to church. Anybody know? Most people know people who don't go to church. How about how many of you know people who are believers, but they believe in some other religious tradition of whatever sort? What are some of the other faith traditions that you have close, you know people who, yeah?
Muslim.
Yeah?
Islam.
What else?
Subud.
What is that?
Subud.
I don't know what that is.
It's an Indonesian Buddhism.
Hmm. Yep.
Wiccan.
Hindu. Wiccan. What's another one?
Buddhism.
Buddhism.
Science of the mind.
Science of the mind.
Native practices.
Uh-huh.
Just nature.
Nature. Yeah.
Scientology.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Varieties of New Age belief.
Yeah. And what about, how many of you know people with what I would call sort of quilt religion? Like they have a piece of this and a piece of that, and they've stitched it together. Maybe you.
Uh-huh. I was just kidding.
Maybe you.
There are people who would argue that we're all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's a good argument to be made for that. Now, how many of you know someone well, someone close to you, who doesn't believe in God? Many of you. So there's something really profound that's happened in the last 500 years in the West. The cultural inheritance which we've inherited, which we're living in, is really different in terms of the possible, what we imagine to be the possible trajectories for a spiritual life. How many of you, I have a brother and two parents who, I don't know if they believe in God or not. I don't really think so. But they're very concerned about how they live their life. And they have moral convictions, and they, I think for the most part, try and be good people. Does that ring true for you? The people you know who don't really believe in God, they're not horrible people, are they, for the most part? Are they really, are some of them even very good people? So that's fascinating, that we can conceive of a life as good and moral. I think we have a seating challenge. Are there open seats near anyone?
Three.
There's three up here if you want to come.
I know some little people but would you want your daughter to marry one?
What? I
talk to a lot of people that their perception of Christianity is the only good thing about Christianity, or the reason for being Christian is so that you will be a good moral person.
Yeah.
But the purpose of it
is
moral.
Yeah. My daughter Grace said a couple of years ago, coming home from church, "Dad, I think grown-ups made up religion for so kids would behave."
There you go.
I talked to a couple that wanted me to officiate at their wedding recently, and they're pagan, and one of the reasons they said they were pagan was because they kind of realized it bothered them that this person said someone could live completely following the Ten Commandments as best as you could, but not believe in God, that they would go to hell, and it didn't make sense to them.
Yeah.
Because the important thing for them was being really good, and if you're really good, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, so one of the interesting trajectories that we're going to look at is how religion became synonymous with being ethical. Being Christian especially became synonymous with being ethical. This icon, actually, of God crossed out is from a pub in Belfast where Peter Rollins started an alternative Christian community, and they were hosting this community in the bar while the bar was open as a way to engage through their religious ritual and engagement with the stories of our tradition, the public. And somebody really disliked that they were having this Christian community meeting in the bar, and so they graffitied the bar. And so, brilliantly, they created a religious ritual outside the bar around this icon as a faithful icon. And what they did was they said, our God always is more than the names that we can use to name God. And so this actually is, in the contemplative tradition in Christianity, a very deep truth that somehow we need to lose our image of God in order to more deeply know God. And it wasn't what the people who made the graffiti intended, but they had fun with it. But even that, what they did with that is a foreshadowing of what I think is really important to think through now as Christian communities, and the kind of imagination that we need for engaging how people are thinking about spirituality. So I want to give some hooks that help us think about this historical trajectory that's changed the way that our culture works. And I think it's hard to do, because the way that our culture works is what we take for granted. So that we don't very often, I mean, if we're professional philosophers or sociologists or something, then we're conscious of it regularly. But most of us, most of the time, aren't conscious of the basic assumptions that inform how we live and what drives our choices and our sense of what a human being is or what a good life is. And in order to explain how we got to where we are, I want to look at a couple of hooks that help us name the changes that took place. And in doing this, I'm drawing from a wonderful Canadian philosopher named Charles Taylor, who has great eyebrows, doesn't he? He retired about 15 years ago, and in his retirement, was invited to give the Gifford Lectures, which is one of the most prestigious lectures in the broadly theological world in Scotland, and at Edinburgh. And he, in doing that, he asked this question: How did we get to what he calls a secular age, when many, many different spiritual trajectories are not only possible but lived as good lives? And he wanted to ask that question about secularity, not in the obvious ways that we think about it. And the obvious ways we think about it are, for example, the United States has a separation between church and state. We don't have a divinely appointed king leading our country. We have an elected president. Sometimes our presidents are pretty religious in their speech, but we still are a country that separates those two. So there's a, and you could argue that in terms of public life, the power of the institution of the church has become less influential over time. And the reasons for that are complicated, but people will sometimes talk about us becoming a more secular country, and what they mean by that is less publicly influenced by institutions of religion. That's one way it's defined. Another way it's defined is people aren't as fervent in their belief as they used to be. People aren't attending church as much as they used to be. So there's that sort of personal religious level of secularism, and that's a common way people talk about it too. And Charles Taylor wanted to ask this third question, this third level of the question, which is about the background. How did we get to be the kind of culture where it's possible to live these very many trajectories of lives, these many different options for spirituality, even in the kind of quilt of one's own religiosity? You know, in our own lives, we have these multiplicities of religious options. And so this is a good way to get at his idea of the background. When you look at this picture, what do you see? What's going on?
Kissing the Blarney Stone.
He's kissing the Blarney Stone. Lovely. What else do people think is going on here?
Microscope.
He's got a little, there's something here. Someone said microscope. What else? What else might be happening here?
A camera.
It could be a camera. Why would he be taking a picture like that?
It's a little
bug. Could be a bug. So who is this guy, do you think? What would you say?
Climber.
Could be a climber.
A searcher.
Could be a geologist.
A searcher.
Searcher. It looks awfully precarious.
Yeah.
Is it you?
No. When we look at a picture like this, and our assumption is that high rock mountains are where God is, then we might look at this picture and say he's worshiping. He's bowing down on top of this rock. And many of us had something along the lines of a scientific answer to what he's doing. And the reason is, obviously, because we live in a culture that gives us a framework for looking at this and saying geologist, or he's investigating the rock, or he's taking a picture of the rock. And that's what Charles Taylor wants to bring to our consciousness when he talks about the level of the background of our culture, the things which our culture offers us to make sense of the world around us. So that's the concept. And the first hook that I wanted to talk about is what Charles Taylor and Max Weber before him and others talk about: the disenchantment of the universe. This is a wonderful cartoon of Sir Isaac Newton. And he was an Englishman and precocious in school, but had a very tough upbringing, and they wanted him to run the family farm, but it was obvious he just wasn't cut out for that. He was a tinkerer, loved to build things and make things, and was excellent in school. So despite their desire to have him run the family farm, they sent him off to Trinity College at Cambridge, where he studied mathematics and the other natural, they called it natural philosophy then. He's, studied natural philosophy and math. And he was appointed to be a professor there, but before that happened, he was in Cambridge, and the plague broke out in London, and then came to Cambridge, and so they closed the college, and people scattered, and he went out to a farm in Lincolnshire. And, you know, there's this great myth about him sitting under an apple tree and an apple dropping and hitting him on the head, and the whole sort of theory of gravitation coming to him in that moment. Well, it didn't probably exactly happen like that, but nonetheless, he does say it was while he was out on this farm in his mid-20s, while he was still a student at Cambridge, when he thought through the mathematics of the theory of gravity and how that related to the moon and the moon orbiting around the Earth and the Earth and the moon orbiting around the sun. And he worked out all the math for this. And so he's remembered as one of the greatest scientific minds and mathematical minds of what we call the modern era or the Enlightenment. And one of the really important, he was a very faithful person. When he died, he laid in state at Westminster Cathedral in London and is buried there, actually, in the cathedral, and wrote more on biblical exegesis than he did on science. He wrote a commentary on Daniel. He wrote some very interesting speculative books on theology. So a very faithful person. But what's interesting is what happens to the understanding of faith in the minds of intellectuals like Sir Isaac Newton. He was drawing on and continuing the work that Rene Descartes had done the generation before him. And one of the key things that happens in his era and with thinkers like him is shifting their understanding of God, and this shift in how they understand God was a very, very influential transition. And I summarized it as from an interventionist God to a God as distant designer. But another way you might put it is in terms of a simple image that was popular at this time of God as a watchmaker. That God made the creation with the intricacies and mechanical intricacies of a watch and wound it up and set it off ticking. And so there's an absolute design and reason embedded in the design for creation, and the job of God is done at that point. And so God isn't actually present in a personal way. God is present by virtue of the imprint of the divine in the sort of structure of how creation works. And so then the job of these natural philosophers was, there's this vast sort of ocean, they would talk about it this way, a vast ocean of truth in front of them in the world, and their object was to try and understand it. And so the scientific method and these experimental projects that they worked on, finding out the logic of gravitation and so forth, were to them holy work, because it was understanding the mind of God. But in doing that, what they do is they do a Bette Midler move. They make God way out there watching from a distance. You remember that song, From a Distance? So the God of the Enlightenment natural philosophers becomes a God who's watching from a distance, how we operate in our life here on Earth. And they had great confidence in this newly developing sort of set of procedures, these methods. Rene Descartes was famous for developing methods for doing this kind of natural philosophical investigation. And Isaac Newton built on that and others. Well, that was for them holy work, but in defining holy work that way, they changed the conception of how God is involved in the world. What wouldn't you expect God to be doing if you have this kind of conception?
Answering prayer,
healing,
punishing,
caring. Well, punishing, they had a very strong image of God as punishing, but not now. God was watching, and at the final judgment, there was this sort of very rational view of God who, like a strict school teacher, keeps a notebook, and you're held accountable for your actions. And it at a certain point, shifted from being actually a conception of God's caring for how you behaved in the world to simply a desire for moral living. And so that the role God has in that, because God isn't judging you now, just at the end of time, there's a real separation even from the judgment of God. So that's an interesting difference. So some of the ways that you might think of God as interacting with us on a daily basis, present with us. For example, we did a baptism this morning, which was just lovely. And they read that Matthew 28 passage. And if you remember the end of Matthew's gospel, Jesus says, "And I am with you to the end of the age." Well, that has no place in this conception of God. I am with you only in the sense that the sort of order of this creation bears the image of God in its rationality. So I am with you in that sense. So it's kind of a cold being with. But one of the interesting contextual things to realize is that this is happening, René Descartes, Sir Isaac Newton, this is happening just after the 30 Years' War between Catholics and Protestants in Europe, in which much of the population of Germany, especially the men, were killed. It was a horrific, bloody war of mainly territorial power between Catholic and Protestant nobility. I mean, it wasn't really about religious conviction, but the combination of religion and politics and territory. So their conviction was, well, you know, dogma is just going to get us killed. So let's try and find out a way to understand how God is present and how we understand the truth of God through different methods than fighting over dogma and territory. So that's one hook. And why disenchantment? Does that make sense to you in some way? How would you make sense of that word, disenchantment, as a way to capture the change that's happening through this period when René Descartes and Sir Isaac Newton and others are doing this kind of work? What's the disenchantment about? Yeah?
It takes the magic out of the universe.
And say,
not enchanting.
And say how? How does it take the magic out?
By describing the laws under which it works.
Yeah. So there's an explanation. I mean, part of the sense of enchantment is that it's, you know, really, it's like me and my Macintosh. I have no idea how it did that. You know, you could make an interesting argument for technology and the re-enchantment of our lives. Any other reactions to that term, disenchantment? What happens in terms of our conception of the world in terms of disenchantment?
Becomes mechanistic.
It really, the whole world becomes enveloped in explanations that are mathematical. If you go into the library and get the volume from the great books of the Western tradition, which we have in the library, and you start reading Sir Isaac Newton's book, it's just full of these diagrams about the, you know, his famous laws of motion. All full of all these mechanical drawings. So nature becomes not magical, not enchanted, but mechanical, rational. So that's very interesting, because this is also, think about it, the time when the Industrial Revolution is just in its infancy. And they're creating a conception of nature as not enchanted, but disenchanted, dispirited, as just material to be understood rationally, and then, not very long after this, exploited rationally as material to support the progress of industrial society. So there's very interesting links between what they're doing theologically and scientifically and then what begins to happen economically and culturally. Yeah?
The it also moves it from the left brain, or from the right brain to the left brain.
It does. That's right.
And giving up the emotion too that goes with the right brain, the subjective truth.
That's right. If you read Rene Descartes, he was very suspect of emotion and of the senses as giving you false evidence about the truth. And so there's a very interesting shift going on in terms of that, what we think of as right brain, left brain.
This kind of connects with the justification for the American Revolution too, that God set everything in motion, but we have to be the ones who make the decision to throw away the king. Design a system based on God's principles. God is mentioned there.
Yeah, but it's a certain understanding of God.
Yeah.
Here's a second really important book in trying to understand this change that transpired. And it's about the understanding of time. This famous painting, 1930, depicts sort of the conclusion of a long shift in how we understand time in the West. And the shift is a shift in how people, on the one hand, oriented their lives to the seasons and to a sort of back and forth between festival time and ordinary time. And let's take an example of Christmas, for example. We have a really weird calendar now because we sort of start anticipating Christmas after Labor Day. Isn't it Labor Day in September or
yes,
late August? Yeah, I always get Labor Day and Memorial Day confused. After Labor Day, sometimes, you know, the big box stores are putting out Christmas stuff, but for sure after Halloween, it's happening. But Christmas itself is kind of a day. You have to be a religious fanatic for the whole 12 days to be celebrated. But Christmas is a day, and we sort of think of the Christmas shopping season as Thanksgiving up to Christmas Day. And so we have calendars and ways of making sense of Christmas, but in terms of vacation, what would you get off if you were a working, ordinary working person? What would you get off for Christmas? Maybe Christmas Eve, Christmas Day. You might take a week of vacation after Christmas, but you wouldn't get it off necessarily. In Scandinavia, in Norway, from the time when it became a Christian society in the 12th century all the way up until the Reformation and the suppression of festivals like this, Christmas was characterized like this. The king, in like 1156 or something, made a law that every farm and community had to brew Christmas beer. And it was to be their best beer of the year, and it was to be their pride and joy. And the Christmas season was to last as long as the beer held out. Hopefully, all the way from Christmas Eve to Epiphany, which would have been the traditional 12 days of Christmas. But it was a festival time when the anticipation of regular work was set aside, and people entered into a whole nother mode of keeping time. And you can imagine what happens when society starts to depend on diligent, serious, regular labor that shows up on time to work. Having that kind of calendar where there's just festivals that go on as long as the beer lasts is really inconvenient. And so there's a slow repression of festivals in this way, and a regularization, a rationalization of the calendar and of our conception of time. And so time becomes much more chronos, the tick, tick, tick of your clock, and much less a pattern of ebbing and flowing, the seasons coming and going, festivals and ordinary time, and much less concern about the specific time. You know, the session started at 4 o'clock, or Christmas Day is that one day. And what's the consequence of that? Well, one of the consequences of that is the rationalization of our lives, that we think of our lives. How many of you, even at Holden Village, have a watch on? You don't need a watch at Holden, really, because the bell rings all the time to let you know. But the watch is a great symbol of what he means by wasted time. We move to a conception of wasted time as making sense. It wouldn't have made any sense at all to people during that era before this rationalization of time. What does wasted time mean to you? It's non-productive time. So what would happen in your lives if it was an example of wasted time? If you said, "Oh, geez, that was just wasted time," what would be an example?
Taking a nap.
Taking a nap. I love taking naps.
Waiting in line at a store.
Waiting in line at a store.
Waiting for something to load or download.
Yeah. It's an easy conception for us to make use of when we think about our daily life. The very fact that it's easy for us to make sense of our lives using that concept shows how ready it is for us to make sense of. It's how we think of time. And if you were to say, we're going to celebrate this holiday until we're done, it would make people really, it would make them feel nervous. I bet, yeah.
Well, just that. To be in Alaska, that still is such Western culture.
It, absolutely.
Well, in the villages, right. That's not how things run. I mean, if you catch a whale, whale comes in, that's what you do is kind of the whale and harvest it. And if the salmon are running, you go fish.
Yeah. Larry Rasmussen was here last week, and one of the things he said was, we're at a time now where we need to, number one, acknowledge that not everyone in the world has adopted this weird thing that we've adopted over the last couple hundred years, and we need to recover these other rhythms from peoples who haven't lost them.
Yeah, and that culture is similar. At least that's been our experience in the hospital. So, and so we bump up against things because we want to schedule your patients to be at 4 o'clock on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Well, if Grantham needs to go get lunch at 4 o'clock on Tuesday, that's what they're going to do. It's because they operate by the need to do, not by the.
One of the interesting things to say about this, its power is because it became dominant culture in some of the most powerful countries in the world. But it's not, certainly not pervasive. There are what I would call minority cultures of a whole variety that haven't fully adopted this, but they have to be, like Du Bois said in The Souls of Black Folk, they have to be aware of a double consciousness because if they're going to interact with the dominant culture, because this is how it works. So it's really, it's very complicated. Ann, you were going to say something.
Well, I've been a support liaison for this last year for a Danish student, actually from Faroe Islands, which I knew very little about. And then in the fall, they take off a full week plus to do a sheep slaughter.
Huh.
And the whole community all over the islands gets together. All the kids get involved in the slaughter and putting the meat, getting ready for winter. And it was, so it's really interesting to hear the community surrounding that event.
So take that example and think about our communities, and when does that happen? When we're, number one, not conscious of how long this is going to take, and number two, all together working on a project.
Well, I think that in funerals, it used to be a full week,
maybe,
and now maybe 3 days.
Yeah.
Now you have maybe gone to come in one day, a funeral, and then maybe the other day, and then you're gone.
Yeah.
So,
just how about church services? How many of you, when you get to church, think, we're going to just kill the fatted calf, and this is going to take as long as it takes? This is the festival of the Lord, you know?
Yeah.
I have a Pentecostal student this past semester for whom that's true. But most churches I've been a part of have been like, 60 minutes or, 90 minutes at the very most. If it's a special day, there's a baptism or it's Easter or something.
At Mount Olivet, the largest Lutheran church, they keep it to 45 minutes.
45 minutes, chop, service after service after service. That's right, in and out. Yeah.
Well, you asked about the watch.
Yeah.
And there's a whole...
You don't have one on.
No, but you know why? is because everybody has a
cell phones,
phone,
right?
But the other thing that's happening is that there's a whole generation of young people coming along now who operate on a whole different kind of a basis. It's like when you get the job done, when for employers hiring these guys coming up, they don't pay as much attention. I mean, it's not an 8-hour day. It's we're going to work till we get the job done, and we're going to take time out. I mean, there's just it's a whole much more flexible mentality when it comes to time, and they don't want watches.
Because there still are moments of life and death, part of that sense of time suspense.
It does. It's a,
you know, you're in ICU and you know that death is near, but you don't know when.
Yeah.
And so what hour of the day or night it is. And when you have a new baby, you're used to sleeping by the clock, but then you sleep by the baby.
Well, and it's fascinating how out of step that is. Say you have a loved one who's near death, you go. Most people do. You go, and everything else gets put off, set aside, and we make that okay, on the whole, and that is almost the only example of a rhythm that is open ended in that way. But it's because the culture doesn't operate that way. It's complicated to do it. It's complicated to extricate yourself from the schedules and have that open-ended time to be with that person, and then re-enter and catch up and all that needs to be done, yeah.
I was just reminded of the announcement of the new head of Yahoo,
uh-huh.
who was a woman who was pregnant.
Huh.
And the second day of the discussion in the media about it, she said, well, I'll take about 3 weeks off and I'll go to sleep.
Huh.
And I thought, oh, yeah. That all depends on what kind of a baby you get and how much of the mother you're going to outsource.
This is her first. This is her first baby.
I would assume so. I would assume so. She's going to have.
This would be why we, even when we think we want to, we can't do Sabbath.
Yeah.
Even if we want to.
It's really. It's
the internal clock is always driving.
Yeah.
And with guilt, I should be doing something right now.
Yeah.
I have to be productive.
It's well, and Sabbath is a concept that's rooted in another era's understanding of what time is. So it's really hard to get outside of our ordinary conception of what time is and be at home in that other. Well, these big changes, the change in conception of who God is and how God relates to the world and how we understand time as a part of our life in the world, unfolded a new understanding, a new set of conceptions for Christian faith. And new humanism, or what Charles Taylor calls the modern moral order. Don't you love the happy humanist symbol? It's sort of Pentecostal. there's 4 points I want to make about the way that these changes affect how Christianity is understood. The eclipse of transcendence happens because the focus, God has retreated, God has created the world and has retreated, and we learn about God by paying attention to the design of creation and understanding through our reason how God has made Earth. So transcendence isn't a focus in the same way. And that has a even more profound impact when you start talking about the development of scientific discoveries about space and about what the heavens are. And people begin to say, well, you know, the moon is there and Mars and Jupiter and so forth, but we haven't seen heaven. Like, heaven isn't necessarily up in the same way that the pictures from earlier eras thought. And so where is transcendence? And so then this question of the shift in character of transcendence happens, and the first thing that happens is transcendence becomes the sort of character of the design of nature and these laws of nature, like discovering gravity for Newton would have been a sign of God's transcendent power, but it's evident in the way that the earth and its and ordinary things work. And that rational sensibility of transcendence in the earth, then, because it's kind of wooden, it's very kind of cold and logical, it gives birth to romanticism, which sees not transcendence in the sky, but transcendence in the beauty, the emotional response that we have to nature, which everyone has when they come up to Holden Village, the sense of the glory of. So there's a kind of a collapse of transcendence in a way into the everyday world that we live in. So earth is sufficient, and the eclipse of grace. Grace is an interruption of the logical working out of things. Think about the parable of the workers who come to the field, and the ones at the beginning of the day are told what the daily wage is, and then workers come later in the day and they're told that they can receive the same daily wage, and people come even at the end of the day, right before quitting time, and they receive the same daily wage. And so there's a parable, in a sense, about the unfairness of grace, the undeserving gift of grace. And that's so inconvenient when you're trying to understand the world by reason and calculation. And so grace is considered a problem related to an old-fashioned idea of God as intervening. And God doesn't intervene. God has created the world the way it is, and our job is to use reason to understand how the world works and not allow for this kind of idea of grace and intervention. And so that takes away mystery. It's the disenchantment idea. And so God's providence in creating the world the way it is evidence of the intention of the Creator, and the mystery, if there is any, is to be overcome. Because you want to know the truth, and so overcoming mystery and knowing the truth becomes the goal. And salvation changes then, because salvation isn't so much about getting to heaven, but about living properly, living as God intended. My classic example of this is Thomas Jefferson, who was deeply influenced by these Enlightenment philosophers, and he created his own Bible. Has anyone seen his Bible? He cut out all the sort of moral teaching parts and then created his own Bible. It basically took out anything that was supernatural. And so that was believable to him. That was evidence of a good life. You could look at someone and see by their behavior that they were a godly person because they behaved
properly.
Yeah,
with actual scissors and paste.
Yeah, right, that's right.
In the original.
So this conception isn't this sort of recognizable Orthodox Christian faith. Really dramatic things change through this period of time in terms of understanding. And one of the key things that happens is the place of God becomes much more distant from everyday life, much more distant and much less personal. And so if you think about, in a way, the withdrawal or the exile of God, then it opens up space for our investigation of how life works. And what happens when we all of a sudden have much more freedom with our own reason and the truth of God put in within us to discover what life is about? Well, lots of people discover lots of different things about how life works. And it puts the impetus on making sense of life in us, rather than this sense of God and how God holds everything together. So it has a distancing of us from God effect, and it has an individualizing effect, because I'm all of a sudden given the reason, the power of reason to explore and understand the world. So this shift from conceptions of self really impacts how we live out our spiritual lives today. This picture is just a way to show a kind of village scene and how that relates to how people thought of themselves. Charles Taylor uses three words to talk about the sense of self. Communal is the most important one. People thought of themselves first as communal persons who were, I mean, many people didn't even have last names. Their last names were either their city or their region that they were from, or related to their family or their clan. And so, and the place where you were born in society was much more durable. There was a sense that your family were tanners or your family were nobles or whatever, and you were born into roles that were much more durable. And the porousness is a sense of our interconnectedness to one another, that when you sneeze, what do people say? Why? Why do they say that?
They don't protect your soul. Your soul is, they believe that your soul is coming out.
We have a conception now of, could be germs or it could be just habit that we say that. But when you go back to the origins of that, it was related to the sense of our endangerment to things around us. We were much more available for either losing our soul in the moment of sneezing, your heart stops. There are all these ideas about what happened in a sneeze. And so it was viewed as this vulnerable portal moment when spirits could invade you. And so the God bless you is literally a blocking of the porousness of yourself to all these other bad spirits that are around and could cause you harm. So it was really a sort of communal practice to help one another not be as vulnerable to our surroundings. And when you look at a farming picture from today, there are two drivers in these two tractors, and the sense of self, Charles Taylor says, isn't durable in the way it used to be. You're able to be whatever you want to be. You're able to explore your gifts and become the person that you become because you're drawing on your distinctive gifts, which may be really different than your parents, not at all related necessarily to what your parents did, and much more oriented to a sense of individuality because of this shift to understanding this gift of reason within you and the capacity that you have to understand the world and to understand your own life and to make sense of it. And buffered is a way just to say we don't understand ourselves to be as vulnerable. We have a kind of sense of our distinct individualness, and it makes us have an orientation to the world as individual selves, not primarily as belonging to a group and having our fate caught up in the fate of that group. So some of the consequences of this play out in how the United States and other cultures like us talk about what life is all about, and I think this description from the founding documents of our country, of the United States, gets at that. We're a people who have protection so that individually we can pursue life, liberty, and happiness. And we pursue that by making decisions for ourselves. We make decisions politically to govern ourselves, we the people of these United States, and we make decisions personally about what we'll do with our family and what we do with our work, and so forth. And this movie, anyone see this movie? Came out maybe 10 years ago. It's basically the American story of someone being down and out and working hard, and by working hard, getting a break and becoming successful. He does this. He pursues life, liberty, and happiness. And at the end of the movie, when he's got his Merrill Lynch stockbroker job and has made it, he says, Will Smith is walking off the screen and he says, this is a moment where happiness exists. You know, he's like just saying all of this individual striving leads to success. And the story is a true story. It's about a guy who was homeless and became a multimillionaire stockbroker. And Horatio Alger told stories like that, American stories of rags to riches. And it's a classic way that our culture thinks of what it is to be a person, to sort of make it up for yourself, to find to find what success is. And these two core values drive it. We're supposed to choose. We're not given who we're supposed to be anymore, and we're not given what it is we're supposed to do. This is a ridiculous example, because I mean, how do you even know? This is at a Cub Foods in Minneapolis. And I counted, there was over 200 soup options in this aisle at Cub Foods. And the poor guy's just like, what's in this one? You know, is this the low salt, low fat version? But the fact of this many soup options just shows us what a culture of choice we have. We as individuals are expected to make choices that make sense for us. And we don't want, really, other people to tell us what to do. A really serious example is our debate about abortion, and our inability to resolve that as a nation is because choice cuts both ways, and it's such a deeply held value. And we struggle with how do we decide as a country to control someone's choice about how they should live. And so that value is connected to this other one. Some people call it, yeah.
And Costco's secret is to reduce the number of choices, because they have done studies that show with that many choices, people are less likely to buy anything.
Yeah. I think it's probably true. Choice is connected to what you might call authenticity, the idea that you have a particular self inside you somewhere, and the goal of life is for that to come out, for you to be true to yourself, to find out who you really are. And that trajectory of growing up, if you think about the task of growing up, very many of us talk about it with our children as, you know, maybe we use theological language of giftedness or whatever, but it's about discerning who I am and who I'm called to be, and then being authentic to that. And it leads to those two together, the desire and value of making choices, and the desire and value for being authentic, and especially being authentic to myself, intertwine in terms of how we live our lives and how we frame our choices and what we imagine is right for us to do. So it has a powerful moral sense to it. Yeah, Anne.
Oh, just kind of a counter movie to the Will Smith one is The Cellist, mm-hmm. where, you know, based on a true story of this cellist who was a young teenager and was prodigy quality and was very, very talented, but then had some mental health issues and ended up on the street. And a journalist discovered his, or learned about his story and tried to pull him out of the LA, out of a homeless situation, but the guy really couldn't make it and pleaded with the journalist to just let him be. But the journalist couldn't let him be.
Wow.
He couldn't believe that he could be happy living in a homeless shelter. So it was just an interesting take on that.
Well, and when I've talked with homeless people, one of the real complaints that I have heard is being forced into situations where they don't have choice.
Right.
And that can be really demeaning. And part of the reason it's demeaning is we define dignity by our individual capacity to choose. And in some cultures now, and in other times and places, that wouldn't even be conceived of, that my lack of individual choice would be something that would take away my dignity. Like we have a bunch of Liberian members at our church, and they talk about the way that they understand family. We have a men's breakfast and we share back and forth. And they have a very different conception of individual versus family. Well, let me just close with this slide. This isn't where I thought I would end, but this is where I am ending. I guess the punchline, which I could say more about, and maybe I'll do another sort of Part B session another time this week, but the punchline is that this set of changes sets up a set of background conceptions for what it is to be a person and how we're to live a life that requires us to cultivate our spiritual life too, to make choices about what's authentic for me. And the Charles Taylor argues that these ideas basically functioned on an intellectual level among a few people until the 50s and 60s, and that those values became much more popularly dispersed through the 1960s, and so they became dominant culture values and not just the values of the elite. And so many, many more people began to think of themselves and their lives in that way. So, like, my parents didn't grow up necessarily thinking that they just could choose whatever religious convictions they wanted. It happened to them after the 60s, after they went through the 60s and 70s. That's when they began to think, huh, do I really have to do this thing that I grew up with and continue being Missouri Synod? You know, my mom grew up in Missouri Synod. She never heard of the theory of evolution until she met my dad when she was 27. And she began to look back on her childhood and then make choices for herself. And that's the driving force behind the multiplicity of spiritual options that people are exploring. These background values, which really give us our understanding of what it is to be a person, open up in a culture when we've had changes in conceptions of God, which make more space actually for us to do that, because we've inherited a society that's based on this kind of rational exploration of truth for ourselves, and that it's possible now for many people to make judgments and say, well, I don't even believe there is a distant designer God out there. This all just unfolded through evolution or whatever. And so we debate all these debates, in a sense, between evolution and creationism are rooted in the same cultural values, the same cultural sensibilities, the background. And so they're all a part of trying to figure out what it is to be spiritual today, what makes sense to people and how they decide they should live. And the spiritual but not religious piece of that, I'll have to save, because we're at the time when we're supposed to end. But you can extrapolate for yourselves how that makes sense when people are trying to figure out how spirituality has integrity for me. And it means, for many, many people, not just accepting whatever this tradition or institution has to say about it, that I need ways to develop that and engage with that for myself. So thank you for coming. I'll stay and chat if you want to talk a little bit more, if anyone has questions or comments. But thank you for coming, and we'll look forward to having a great week together.